Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. It's open lines for your questions and your comments. Now, we've been doing audio open lines quite a bit, and what we'll do is bring you a little bit of this and a little bit of that, kind of a digest, a little clearinghouse for news that might interest you, news that bears upon your life as a Christian in the world. Well, here's what I heard. Great interview. And while at the same time kind of frustrating, you ever have that one of those, they call them driveway moments, but I had one cruising along old 156 in southern Illinois, or maybe it was Route 4, I can't remember which one, Sunday morning. The driveway moment is the moment as a radio listener where you pull into your driveway, get into the garage, even close the garage door, but you can't get out of your car because you can't stop listening to what you're hearing. And I had one of those Sunday morning, even though I was going probably 60, 65 miles an hour, I couldn't stop listening. I was really hoping that this church I was driving to was far enough away so that I could hear the entire interview I was listening to. What was it? The show was called The Interview. Carrie Gracie is the host. It's on the BBC. You have to get up pretty early in the morning on Sunday to hear it. But the guest was Greg Kokel. Now, it's not unusual for Greg to do interviews like this. I've heard him on a number of different places. In fact, I've heard him National Public Radio also interviewed as well. So it's not unusual. That's not what caught my attention. What caught my attention was, normally when I talk to Greg, Greg and I agree on abortion, probably on 99% of what we think about the abortion issue. So I'll ask him questions, and I will ask devil's advocate questions. But I'm not the devil, nor am I the devil's advocate. Everybody knows Wilkin agrees with Kokel. Well, Carrie Gracie didn't agree with Greg Kokel. And that becomes pretty clear in the course of this BBC The Interview conversation that they had. It wasn't hostile. She was fair, and I think Greg answered fairly as well. But I thought it would be a great opportunity for you to hear one of your favorite guests, Greg Kokel, the one who brought us all of these techniques for how to engage in dialogue and debate with people who disagree with you, the Colombo technique. He's brought all of these things to you, our listeners, to see him do it in real time, right there with someone who doesn't agree with him, and to watch how the conversation goes. In fact, I was thinking while I was listening to it, would I have the kind of courage it takes to do an interview like this with someone who just obviously disagrees with me on something like abortion? And her questions aren't easy, folks. She's a trained interviewer. She knows how to ask the tough questions. So I want you to hear this interview. We'll stop it and we'll start it. Your reaction here during audio open lines, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. By the way, some of you might have been hoping we'd do a sermon review today. Since yesterday was Mother's Day, we will do one tomorrow. We're going to do the sermon that Robert Schuller Jr. preached at the Crystal Cathedral on Mother's Day yesterday. Probably that one. We might be able to find something else. Maybe Joel Osteen did one. We'll find out tomorrow, but we'll do that sermon review tomorrow on Issues, Etc. The program's called The Interview. It's on the BBC. The interviewer is Carrie Gracie, and her guest is Greg Kokel. Their topic is abortion.
Do you see yourself as some kind of foot soldier in a moral crusade?
Well, I guess I'd say yes to some degree. I am. I mean, there's a lot of things that I'm concerned with in the American culture and the direction it's going. But as a human being, as I look at the moral equation that relates to the abortion question, it seems to me if the unborn is in fact a human being who is innocent, and his life is being taken for reasons that we wouldn't normally justify taking the life of another human being, all people here in this country and other countries, I think, need to step forward and do what they can.
And you're a Christian.
That's right.
Is that where it all begins for you? I mean, does it have something to do with your religious faith, your moral position on this?
Actually, what's curious about my position is the case that I make has no reference to my Christianity whatsoever. What we do at Stand to Reason, the organization that I represent, is we try to make a case against abortion that will resonate with people who do not have religious convictions, because I don't think ultimately this is a religious concern. I think it's a human concern that all human beings, even atheists, quite frankly, can get behind if they understand the moral equation. And so what we use is we use science with moral reasoning. Morality is a field of philosophy. Moral reasoning that we think is accessible to everyone, regardless of their religious convictions, to ask the question whether we can make a legitimate moral judgment with regards to acts of abortion.
And your case, we've heard some of it, but is the objective to rule out, make abortion illegal altogether?
Okay, well, my conclusion is elective abortion does not represent a morally legitimate action and therefore should not be allowed.
All right. Thank you very much, Craig. Craig was on the ball, stopping it before I even pointed my finger. First of all, I think these are fair questions for a guy like Greg Kokel, who is going to come to the abortion issue as an opponent of what he calls elective abortion. I think that's a great term. That's a great term that pro-lifers ought to learn and start using, elective abortion. Now, we know what elective surgery is, don't we? Elective surgery is something that you don't have to have done, but you might have it done. I mean, some surgeries are kind of necessary, like if you have a hernia. You can let it go for the rest of your life and be uncomfortable and perhaps deal with some complications in the future, or you can elect to have surgery. And they might call that elective surgery. You go to your insurance company and you say, I really have to have this, so that they'll pay for it. Then there's something like plastic surgery, where you don't have to have a nose job. And it is surgery, but no one's telling you there are no emergency nose jobs, as far as I know. Yeah, I know some people would argue. They would say they have to have that nose job, but you don't have to. I mean, there's... And so you would say, well, that's elective surgery. I decided, I chose to have that surgery. And I'm glad that Greg is using that term for abortion, elective abortion. What he wants to see made illegal is elective abortion. Simply having an abortion because you choose to. And the great thing about this term is it really does kind of, in a very subtle way, establish the moral high ground. Because it already says... These women don't have to have these abortions. They're deciding to have those abortions. The other great thing about this term is that it is, it's a neutral term. Election has to do with choice, doesn't it? And so he's kind of taking the opponent's view where they say, look, we should have the choice to have abortion. And he says, no, let's talk about that choice to have an abortion. If the only reason you're having it because you want it, not because you need it, and we can talk later about who needs it and who doesn't, if anyone. The only reason you're having the abortion is because you chose to, for whatever reason, but it was your choice. That's what I like about this term, elective abortion, that he's using. There's another thing he's done here, and I'd like your reaction to it. It's open lines, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. He has carefully ignored the bait. Now, he knows what he's doing. He's done this a million times. Her first question had to do with, do you consider yourself a moral crusader? And he says, look, what I want to see is elective abortion stopped because it takes an innocent human life. And then she pressed that same question just one more. Well, you're a Christian. Is that where you begin with this? Are you pro-life because you're a Christian? Now, did you notice Greg's answer? It was, well, I certainly am a Christian, and there are moral considerations here. But his approach to the issue, whether he's pro-life because he's a Christian or not, his approach is scientific, with moral reasoning, he said. Something that's open to anybody. Just because someone says abortion is wrong doesn't mean that, in general conversation, does not mean that they are approaching it on a religious basis. So he's already in two answers taken away, disarmed the interviewer of two things that she would like to use. And you'll find out later, she really would like to use these things, would like to use to either discredit him or create the impression with the listeners that his objections to abortion are some personal opinion, kooky religious idea. Now, you got to remember this when you're having this conversation with people. I've had conversations here on the air. You've heard them with listeners who've said, look, the only reason you're pro-life is because you're a Christian. You have religious objections. We had one last week, didn't we? Yeah, we had one last week who called in and said, you're just raising religious objections. And I said, no, it really is scientific. When does life begin? That's not a religious question, or at least not exclusively a religious question. And the caller, if you remember, said, well, you're not going to make everyone into a fundamentalist Christian. Now, had I not spent a lot of time talking with Greg Kokel on the air, I would not have known to simply let that one fly right past me. Because it's not the issue. Let's see how Greg Kokel's doing. The next question from the interviewer, this is from the BBC. The program's called The Interview. Greg Kokel is being interviewed by Carrie Gracie.
So you'd like to ban abortion in the United States and what, around the world?
If abortion takes the life of an innocent human being, it doesn't matter what country it happens in. It's still an immoral action. And so to the degree that I have influence, I would like to decrease the number of abortions wherever they happen.
And I hear what you're saying about your method of moral discussion and mm-hmm. scientific evidence. Mm-hmm. Now, how else, what else comes into your campaigning, which you do on your website, I know, and on your radio station? Do you use on your website the graphic images which many anti-abortion campaigners use of aborted fetuses?
We do. I don't think we have anything on our website, Carrie, but we do think this is a legitimate way of doing business. We stand in a long-term tradition of using graphic imagery, photographs even, to make a moral case for something. And this goes far back. I mean, we have the civil rights movement in the United States in the 60s in which blacks were being hung. Those images were posted on billboards around the country to make the case for civil rights. We've just recently, pictures of Abu Ghraib have been circulated all over the world because people understand that in order to have a reasonable discussion about any weighty moral issue, they've got to know what they're talking about. And so what we use is we're in favor of using images that will help people to see what it is that we're talking about.
And is it okay then for your opponents to use graphic shocking images and photographs as well to make their argument, for example, of rape victims or of unwanted orphans in suffering or of women who've died of infections after backstreet abortions in countries where abortion is illegal? I mean, do you see the legitimacy of that use of graphic images enemy?
Oh, absolutely. I think that every side has the liberty to use the best means of legitimate persuasion that's at their disposal. Here's the warning, though, and this is something that we try to keep in mind over at Stand to Reason, when we're promoting the photos to make our case. First, the photos have to be accurate and give an accurate picture of what's going on. The second thing is we don't want to just carry our point simply with a vivid photo, but we want to bolster that with an argument.
Just to pursue this a little further,
sure.
90% of all abortions take place within 12 weeks mm-hmm. of conception. So are the photographs that you're using of aborted fetuses before 12 weeks?
All right, before he answers that, I want you to notice where she's going. Now, the question she had asked is a perfectly legitimate question. Are you in favor of using graphic photos in order to make your case against abortion? And he says, in principle, yes, we are, because that has been kind of part of the legitimate moral discussion on many other issues. And he's very smart to mention Abu Ghraib, especially realizing that he's got a worldwide audience listening. BBC is broadcast all over the world, and especially to Europe. So he knows he's got an audience there that who have seen the Abu Ghraib photos, who have been happy to see them, not because they like what they see, but because they, say, believe that the war in Iraq is wrong, and this is all part and parcel of the war in Iraq being wrong. So he knows his audience, and he, rather than just saying, we can use those images because that's what really happens in an abortion, that's true. But think about making the point the way he made it, rather than, well, this is what happens in an abortion. Are you afraid to look at it? Rather saying, well, of course we use graphic images. Some of the greatest moral enterprises in Western civilization in the 20th century have used graphic images. I thought of one that I thought he was going to mention it, but he didn't. Images of Holocaust victims. Now, I just said that. What did you picture? You pictured skeletal men and women and children in muddy internment camps, didn't you? Or you might have pictured dead people. Dead bodies piled like cordwood, didn't you? Now, those images are in your mind because there has been a case made, rightly so, against genocide with those images. And the images have become part of the moral argument. They were rightly used there, and there's a case to be made for rightly using the graphic images when it comes to abortion. Now, what she's asking next is, and that's why I said, watch where she's going in this interview with Greg Kokel. What she asks next is, well, how early are these pictures shown? Because most of the abortions take place before the child is really recognizable as a child. Let's see what Greg has to say.
Or are they after? Because, of course, the much more shocking images are those where the fetus looks more like a baby. Yeah. And then it shocks. But, of course, in a way, that might according to your argument, be misrepresentative, because those are only very rare cases.
Well, if those are examples of late-term abortions and this is shocking, then that would certainly be an argument that late-term abortions are morally questionable. But to answer your question directly, Carrie, we actually show a range of photos from the earliest to the latest. Now, in the very first stages, in the first couple of weeks, there's very little formation of the recognizable human form. But one of the things we do is not only do we show pictures of abortions and aborted fetuses, but we also show pictures through a methodology called embryoscopy, where you actually can put a camera inside the womb and look at a living child. And one of the things that I use most frequently, frankly, is an embryoscopy of a 9-week gestation age child waking up in the morning. It's powerful. It's really incredible, beautiful to see. And I think this shows that what we're talking about is a bona fide human being, even the most earliest stages of development.
And that image, of course, would be a powerful one, I can imagine, for many women in considering abortion. But let's turn to another form of persuasion, legitimate or otherwise, and I'm interested to hear whether you think it
sure.
is. In the United States, there is a lot of standing outside abortion clinics shouting at people going into them by the people who share your argument, you know, with placards, rapping on the glass of car windows and that kind of thing.
Right.
What do you think about that? Because sometimes it looks intimidating, doesn't it?
Right. It's hard sometimes when the images that one gets of a movement, as it were, are just those selected by the press. Actually, there are laws in this country now that have been placed for a long time that disallow that kind of thing, so it almost never happens. What is more the case is people that are on the sidewalks that are attempting to persuade those who will talk to them, and they have to stay a certain distance from the clinic itself. So
I just have to tell you that a reporter of ours, a BBC reporter, was in Mississippi recently, and I think there's only one abortion clinic in Mississippi now, and she said, standing outside there, that the atmosphere was quite intimidating for women who might be going into that clinic, that there was a lot of shouting and criticism.
Okay, well, there may be occasions of that, you know, and I'm not denying that that's the case, and I'm saying that characteristically, and I've worked with a lot of groups that have been out and trying to make their case, and we train a lot of them. Ours is a persuasive enterprise, not an intimidation enterprise, at least the one that I'm promoting. And I think when people on our side are doing those things, I think they hurt the message.
And recently, anti-abortion campaigners have been making headway, or it looks from the outside as if they are, in the United States, most recently, of course, with South Dakota banning abortion in a direct challenge to the national law, at least eight other states wanting to challenge as well. Do you feel the tide is turning in your direction?
All right, before he gets to that response, couple things. First of all, you cannot fault Carrie Gracie, the host of the interview, for asking these questions. These are really good questions that anyone who puts themselves forward as an advocate for life in the public arena ought to be able to answer, especially if you have some sort of organization like Greg does, Greg Kokel, that advocates for fighting against abortion legally, philosophically, morally. So we ought to be able to answer these questions about the use of graphic images and the fact that if you're just showing, and I love the way Greg has prepared for this. This is the advantage of having someone like Greg Kokel who says, I have to think like my opponent. That's how he comes up with the arguments and the responses that he does. He thinks like the person he disagrees with. That is very hard for us to do. Very hard for us to do. And I could tell you, as someone who does this for a living, that thinking like someone I disagree with, because I spend all day long agreeing with myself, is one of the hardest parts of this job. In fact, it's not just a one-man job. It's a two-man job. That's why I have Jeff. Jeff is here in large part not only to schedule guests, but also to help me think like someone I disagree with, either the listener or the caller or the guest, because I'm very accustomed to thinking like I think. That's why he can respond, and he's ready to respond to this question of, well, if you're showing graphic images of aborted fetuses, where we can actually see hands and feet, you're not really fairly representing the number of the kinds of abortions being done in the U.S., because the majority of them are done first trimester, early first trimester, and there's not a lot to see in those images. So she says, if you're showing these later abortions, you're not really giving people an accurate picture of what abortion is. What's his response? He's anticipated it. And this is another good thing for us to learn. In order to anticipate these kind of questions, you have to stop thinking about your side of the issue and think about the other person's side of the issue. That doesn't mean you agree with them. It means that you think of their side of the issue. His response is, we have a whole range of pictures that we show. We try to fairly represent an abortion early, an abortion midterm, an abortion late. But the lesson I want you to take away as a listener, the one I certainly have learned by listening to Greg Kokel, not only here but in conversation with him here on Issues, etc., is one of the most important things you can do is think outside your side of the issue. You will better understand and be able to articulate your viewpoint, whether it's life or anything else, if you can think like someone who doesn't agree with you. But it isn't easy. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Listening to a conversation between Carrie Gracie, host of The Interview on the BBC, and a regular guest here on Issues Etc., Greg Kokel. He's being grilled. Now, the heat's going to turn up right about now in answering this question that she just put to him, having to do with the use of intimidating techniques at abortion clinics. Let's see if we can get this answer in before the break.
Well, I feel the tide has been turning in our direction, principally because of the partial birth abortion debate here in the States. That was a bill that was passed to ban a certain type of what is called abortion. It's when the child is delivered 90% out, in a breech position, the head is still in the birth canal, and then the baby's head is punctured, and the brains are evacuated, which, of course, kills the child, and then the child is removed entirely. Now, just with that simple description, you can see this is a barbaric procedure, and when people realized what was going on, many people rallied against this, even people who are very much in favor of the pro-choice view for regular abortions. And see, what this has done, I think people get, and this, again, a kind of a visual representation, they see what's at stake here. And
it's interesting,
people,
though,
I think
because
this has changed the pace a bit.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but it's interesting, right, this example, because that's obviously a very, very tiny percentage of abortions, isn't it? But it gives abortions as a whole a bad name.
It is a tiny percentage. It's not, I mean, it's something like 3 or 4 super airliners crashing per year, you know, which from that perspective, it's significant, even if it's a small percentage. But I'll tell you, Carrie, what it does is it educates people about something that's going on, because people start thinking, you know, this is barbaric, this action, even though it's called an abortion, and we don't want this. And this is why the ban has gone forth in this country. It's under judicial a challenge right now, but in the event it's been passed and a lot of people want this ban, and it becomes a way of instructing them about the morality of the circumstance. And I think, you know, this debate.
Let's, Greg, I'm going to stop.
Okay, we'll have to stop her because we're coming up on a break. But notice a couple things he did there real quickly. When she said, well, partial birth abortion barely ever happens, he says, yeah, it does barely ever happen. It only amounts to about 2 or 3 airliners crashing every year. If you were running an airline and you were crashing 2 or 3 of them every year full of people, that'd be a problem. So while she wants to represent it as a small part of the problem, the numbers are still significant. And it still takes place. The other thing he did there was he didn't use the word infanticide. He could have. He almost did. But in talking about partial birth abortion, he said this procedure that is often called abortion. Now, he did not use the word infanticide. I think I know why. I'll explain after the break.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The reformer Martin Luther and his theology have been understood and misunderstood for almost 500 years. Was Luther's theology merely warmed over Roman Catholicism? Was Luther a Protestant? How important were the ideas of sin, grace, and the justification of the sinner to Luther's thought, theology, and Reformation? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May is called A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. To find out more, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the Issues Etc. book of the month for May, A Theology to Live By, right there at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for A Theology to Live By.
White people, did you know there aren't any? Answers with Ken Ham, co-author of the book that combats racism called One Blood.
Ken, now you have me really puzzled. How can you say there aren't any white people?
You know, most have the idea that people over the earth have different colored skin. Actually, there's really only one color, and just various shades of it. The main pigment we have in our skin is called melanin. There are two forms of this pigment that together give people their skin color, which is a sort of brown. Now, if people have a small amount of melanin, their skin will be a very light shade of brown. These people are often referred to as white. If people have a lot of melanin in their skin, they'll look very dark and be referred to as black. But even though there are a few other pigments and they have very little bearing on skin color, all humans, except albinos, of course, have the same skin color. So in reality, there aren't any white people at all. You know, to understand why some groups of people have dark skin and some light and some other shades, we have to consider what happened at the Tower of Babel. When people groups split up because of language differences, different genetic variations ended up in different groups of people. This history from the book of Genesis in the Bible actually explains what we see in the world today with the distinct groups of people.
The Bible not only answers the question about the origin of people groups, but also that tricky question, where did Cain find his wife? Our booklets on both of these topics can be found on our website, AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
President Dean Wenthy on the future of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
In every way, I can't believe the blessings that we have been given. As we Lutherans say, not with any merit or worthiness on our part, but by God's grace, He continues to lead talented, dedicated men and women to give their lives to Him and to the truth of the gospel. And I'd like to invite any of your listeners to come and visit us, but more than visit, worship with us, be my guest for a campus tour, and see how our life revolves around this wonderful truth that the incarnate Christ has brought to our world.
To accept Dr. Wenthy's invitation for an on-campus tour at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, call 1-800-481-2155.
The Missouri Historical Society's African American History Series is a monthly series of presentations exploring current research related to the experience of African Americans. With the 2005 and 2006 series drawing to an end, it's time to re-examine what has been taught. The May program, entitled Understanding It Better in Order to Move Forward, is being held on Saturday, May 20th from 10 until 11 at the Missouri History Museum at Lindell and the Bolivar in Forest Park.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're listening to an interview between Carrie Gracie of The Interview on the BBC and Greg Kokel, a regular guest here on the program of Stand to Reason. They're talking about abortion, and he is, in the course of this interview, doing a pretty good job of defending his position. And when he comes on this program, we very seldom make him defend his position except by way of kind of friendly devil's advocate questions. But now he's having to take the questions that he knows what Wilkins is going to ask him before we ever ask, because I'm predictable. I'm just like an old shoe. But I imagine he doesn't anticipate some of these questions that he's getting in this interview, and this is a chance to see someone like Greg Kokel, who many of you value as a regular guest on Issues Etc., as kind of in his element doing the thing he does. And I have learned a lot, and I think you have too, by having him as a guest, but also I think I'm learning even more in all those years just listening to this one interview that he had with Gracie Carey. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850. I'm sorry, Carey Gracie, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If you'd like to chime in with a question or a comment or even a criticism, that's fine. If you think the answer did not rise to the Kokel level, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, I wanted to mention this because tomorrow morning, talk about getting up early for an interview, Gretchen Passantino, what time would she have to get up in Costa Mesa, California to make a 7:30 interview on the East Coast?
4:30
in the morning.
Get up before that.
She has to get up before that to make this interview. Tomorrow morning on Good Morning America, Gretchen Passantino is going to be a guest. She's going to be one of the guests discussing Bob Larson, who, of course, many of you know the name. He's made a lot of money on books on spiritual warfare, on power, what does he call it? Power encounters. And he is a self-styled exorcist, talks a lot about the demon world. Gretchen Passantino will be responding some of that tomorrow morning at 6:30 a.m. So you'll have to get up early, too, to see Gretchen Passantino on Good Morning America. I'm already up at 6:30. So all I have to do is turn on the TV and find the right channel. Good Morning America, Gretchen Passantino of Answers in Action, another regular guest here on Issues, Etc., talking about Bob Larson. Let's go back to the interview between Kerry Gracie and Greg Kochel.
I'm going to stop you there because I think we need to deal with the morality then head on. I mean, you've talked about this quite a lot now, and I just want to kind of look at it quite closely. If abortion, in your view, is murder, is it the same order of murder as taking a knife and plunging it into another conscious human being?
Yeah. First of all, I don't actually use the word to describe that. I think it's a homicide, partly because just from a linguistic perspective, it's an alarming kind of word. So I'd rather explain, as you've invited me to do. Abortion actually does plunge a knife into an innocent human being as a matter of just clinical kind of observation. The unborn is a human being at a certain stage of a human being's natural development.
I'm going to stop you on that one as well, because that's something you've now said several times. But, of course, many people, embryologists, moralists, you name it, would profoundly disagree with you about that. They would say that the embryo, during the first few weeks of its existence, is a potential human being, something that in future may or may not become a human being, unless it aborts naturally or aborts artificially, will become a human being. But it is not actually a human being and therefore does not have the rights of a human being. It doesn't have consciousness. It doesn't have spirituality. It's a soup, a mass of cells.
Okay.
Now, before he answers, she's going in a direction, a good direction. Her questioning might be a little bit hostile. I mean, she does interrupt him at certain points. She doesn't want him to simply make a statement that the embryo is a human being. I think the reason that Greg is using that term so frequently is because, too, he wants people to hear what his position is. But also, I think he wants her to ask or to raise the question she just did, which is, well, it's not a human being. Many embryologists think it isn't a human being. And so how can you say it is a human being? Now, all she's doing, she's not being unfair. All she's doing is asking him to defend his statement. And that's not unfair at all. She's simply asking him to defend his contention that the embryo is a human being. And he should invite such a question, as he does.
Okay, let's talk about that for a moment. This will take a few seconds to develop because, first of all, I don't know of any embryologist that says that. Because the thing that is growing inside the mother is some living kind of thing. And we have to ask this. There's no question that it's growing. That's the problem. It's alive. It's a separate being from the mother. And we know this because it has a separate DNA from the mother. Now, the question is, what kind of being is growing in the mother? And I usually just do something funny with audiences when they ask this question. I say, if your cat is in the family way, you know, what kind of critters are growing inside the cat? Well, those are kittens that are growing in there, or cat feti, if you will. There's no question when the thing is born what kind of creature it is.
No, there may not be a question when that thing is born, but you wouldn't call it a kitten, or most people I would put to you would not call it a kitten from the moment of conception.
No, you wouldn't call it a kitten because a kitten usually is the phrase that we use for something that is born and furry and whatever. But you would use the scientific name that describes that particular genus of thing.
Yes,
just like I say human being.
You would call it, and I have to tell you that in the UK, for example, the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority have discussed this endlessly, and they would not take the view. I mean, they would not take your view that this is, from conception, a human being.
Well, the question I would ask is, what is it then?
That an embryo.
Well, it's an embryo, but embryo is a stage of development, just like a teenager is. So what kind of embryo is the question. Well, we know we can look at the medical books. It says here is a human embryo.
They would say it is a mass of cells which are doing something interesting, but which is not, at the point of conception, a human being. And I don't think we should spend too long on this, because clearly your view is not going to coincide with the view of all these other people. But I think at least we've explored somewhere this moral mm-hmm. ground, which is so battled over. Mm-hmm. And I want to return now to you.
Okay, before she returns, notice how quickly she avoided. Now, this makes a great case. A couple things. When I was listening to this, I was driving along. This is the point where I realized I'd been not paying attention to where I was driving. I was supposed to go through from my little house in Waterloo down through Redbud and then through Baldwin and then through Sparta and then take a right-hand turn to go down to Steelville. And at this point in the interview, after this answer is done, I realize, oh, my goodness, just at the point where he starts to make his case that the embryo, it's an embryo, but an embryo is just a stage of development. It's an embryo of what? The minute that question comes up, she wants to move on to something else. Now, I don't know if she was pressed for time. She might have been pressed for time. She might have had her producer yelling in her ear, move on, move on. Those kind of things happen. But more often than not, when someone stops wanting to talk about the embryo, it's a good sign that what they even though they can talk about a mass of cells or a soup of group of cells doing something interesting, they don't want to talk about the embryo. Greg Kokel, his colleague there, Scott Klusendorf, or his former colleague there, Scott Klusendorf, make this case beautifully. The center of the debate is who is the embryo or what is the embryo? What is the unborn? If you stay on that subject, you will find your opponents who are in favor of abortion doing anything, everything they can not to talk about it. We've done it here on this program with callers who will call in. And the more you want to talk about the embryo, the more words they make up to describe that thing other than embryo. Pre-embryo, mass of cells. Look, genetically, it's human. It's living, it's growing. It is in that stage of development we call an embryo, but that doesn't completely describe it. Is it, put those two together, is it in fact a human embryo? Potential life is what they say. Notice how the terms, their description of the embryo, always avoids describing what the embryo is. A potential human being. Do you know any potential human beings? I've never met one.
I did in high school.
You did?
High school.
Oh, in high school. You met a potential human being. Apparently, the only place they exist is for a few short weeks in a mother's womb. They're not human beings. They're potential human beings. Now, in a way, this is a bit of a victory. Because you get the pro-choicer to admit that there is this very, very tiny window where, now, they're not right. The embryo is an embryo from the time of, is a human being from the time of conception. There's no doubt about this. Medically or philosophically or metaphysically, there's no doubt about it. But you get them to paint themselves into a corner. Now, Greg is very polite, and he's not going to do that with this interviewer. But he could well have said, so really, you would only advocate for abortion only in that narrow stage of development called embryo. It's only a couple weeks long. Now, she would have to say, well, no, I would advocate for abortion past that. Well, wait a minute. You said it's a human being past that, didn't you? But focusing on the embryo often requires the person who is pro-choice to paint themselves into a corner that smaller and smaller amount of time where they would argue that the human embryo isn't human at all. But for some reason, they continue to advocate the destruction of that human embryo even past that stage. So it's really about who the embryo is, not only as an embryo, but even after that. You know, if you ever doubted that the real center of the debate in the abortion issue was who is the unborn, this interview is proving it in spades. Now, she's the interviewer. She gets to change the subject if she wants to, and she will.
Mm-hmm. And I want to return now to your view about the rights of this mm-hmm. this thing, this potential life in the view of some, this actual life in view, your view, and just question you, do you think then that the embryo, the human embryo, has the same right to life as the mother, for example?
Yes, I do.
And any pregnant woman then who aborts her fetus is committing homicide?
Is taking the life of another innocent human being. That's correct.
And what then do you think is the appropriate punishment for that?
Well, that's a harder question. In fact, they had a struggle with that in the laws here in the States, but I'm not a legal mind able to figure out what the best punishment would be for those things. But the odd thing is that there's protection given to the unborn, even to the point of calling killing the unborn homicide, with the exception of abortion. And there is a radical inconsistency. Why would it be homicide to kill the unborn in other circumstances if the unborn wasn't, in fact, a valuable human being?
And some forms of homicide in the United States are punishable by death. Just out of interest, do you support the death penalty?
I do in general, depending on the crime.
Despite your view that we all have a right to life?
Yes, I don't think it's an absolute right. I think sometimes that life can be forfeit under the right circumstances. And I think that capital punishment is a fitting, all things being equal, is a fitting punishment for capital crimes.
You're listening to the interview in the BBC World Service with me, Carrie Gracie, and my guest today, American anti-abortion campaigner Greg Kokel. Greg, let's talk about your personal dimension on all of this. Do you have any experience of abortion?
Well, I haven't had one myself, but I will tell you, my wife has had two abortions, actually. That's the closest it comes. My sister has also had an abortion when she was about 17 years old.
And do they agree with you that in doing so, they committed a homicide?
Yes, they both do.
Well, that must be quite painful for them.
Well, it is. It's not just painful for them, but it's painful for a lot of women who have abortions, even if they don't hold my view, even though they might feel that under their circumstances their abortions were justified. I don't think my wife or my sisters think that now as they look back on it. My sister was actually pressured by others to have the abortion, and that's often the case. But my wife, that was her own choice. But I think most people have this sense that something is morally suspect about this. And this is why we kind of lower our voices when we talk about it in grave tones. I know it's a tragedy, but we should allow women to do it kind of language. And my question is, what is it that's tragic about it if there is not a human being involved here? If it's just a clump of cells, as you alluded to earlier, if that's all it is, people don't have tragic feelings about having their tonsils removed.
And so did you and she come to this similar moral and emotional position independently, or did you persuade her, or did she persuade you?
Before he answers, she played a subtle little thing there. I think probably the women in the audience would have caught it better than the men. And I didn't even catch it until probably the second time I heard this. And that was, in asking the question about his wife, who had had several abortions before they met, before she was pro-life, and another family member of his who had had an abortion. And she says, well, do they share your view that this is equivalent to homicide? And he says, yes, they do. And her response was, well, that must be very painful for them. Now, what she's trying to do is say, it's your moral position that makes them feel guilty. The pain can all go away if you just say, it's okay. What you did wasn't wrong. Greg is very unflappable in this respect. He says, yes, it is. It is painful for them. Another great thing to point out, and that is sometimes people who will argue with you about abortion know from first-hand experience how painful it is. Maybe they've had one. Maybe they know someone who's had one. Maybe it's the boyfriend who talked the girl into it, and he knows from first-hand experience that it destroyed the relationship, or if it didn't destroy the relationship, he saw the pain that his girlfriend or his wife was going through. You need to bear that in mind. I mean, there is another very persuasive way of dealing with this, and that is, as much as people want to deny it, you know, there's, I think it's probably Kate Michelman, if I'm not mistaken, head of one of the big pro-choice groups, who says she had abortions, never regretted it. Maybe she didn't, but she would be unique among women who never regretted it.
No, actually, when we met, I was speaking at a crisis pregnancy center, which is an organization that helps with women who decide to keep their children, and she was actually working there, and that's how we met. So we both held these convictions, and it just happened to be that we met there.
So obviously she then had these abortions before she knew you.
That's correct.
And do you have children?
Well, my wife was a single mom. The third time she got pregnant, she kept her child. His name's Dane, and he's 24 years old now. He's 6'5", a big strapping guy, and he's a super guy. When we got married, I got married late in life. I got married four days before my 48th birthday, so I was a late bloomer there, Carrie. Mm-hmm. My wife was 9 years younger, but we tried to have children since then, and we haven't been able to. You know, our gametes are a little bit tired, I guess, and so what we did is a year ago we adopted a little girl. And it makes me a 55-year-old first-time dad, people are sympathetic for me. But I have a great wife and a great little girl. The problem is people say, wait until she becomes a teenager, and then she'll really be a terror. And I tell them, well, look, if I'm lucky, I'll be dead by then, you know.
And Greg, just to sort out one thing in my mind, your adopted daughter then, is she the child of someone who didn't want a child and who went ahead with a pregnancy that they actually didn't want the child from?
Well, it's a little more complex than that. This was a young lady who was 17, I believe, when she got pregnant. She was a freshman in college, and this was unexpected, obviously, and a problem because she was not in any position to be able to take care of this child, and she had a future ahead of her that she wanted to pursue. And initially, she was abortion-minded and then chose against abortion and chose rather to adopt out.
And were you involved in her decision to go ahead with the pregnancy?
We were not involved with the decision on the abortion side. But as it turned out, since this young lady was a member of a pastor friend, a member of his church, he asked, once she decided to keep the baby, if my wife would talk to her by phone, because my wife had kept her child, too, and so she wanted some counsel. So she was involved in that stage, but she really left the choice to adopt out or to keep the baby up to the woman. It was only after she decided to keep the baby did we then express our interest in being on the list, as it were, and she ended up choosing us as the parents.
And how does she feel looking back on the decisions that she took then? I mean, do you still keep in touch with her?
We do. It's an open adoption. And, of course, when a woman gives away her child, this is a painful experience. And we understand that. And we wanted her to be involved in some measure in the life of the baby that she bore, even though we are now the legal parents of that baby. So she sees the baby every 2 or 3 months, and it's really a great thing. She is glad that she didn't take the life of the child through abortion. This is something she has no second thoughts about, and she actually has no second thoughts about giving the baby up for adoption, though, as you can imagine, this is an emotionally charged circumstance.
And I know,
she's really happy with us, though, as parents, and that makes it easier.
Yes, and I know that this isn't your only experience of someone close to you giving up a child for adoption, because you have a niece who I think was a victim of a rape.
Yes, as a matter of fact, that's true. My niece was raped when she was 14 years old, and she got pregnant and gave the child up for adoption. This was one of the hardest things for her to do, and it's actually an interesting wrinkle in this discussion, Carrie, that people usually raise the rape question. My niece had no desire to separate herself from this baby. It wasn't as if the baby was a reminder of the rape. The baby was more redemptive in her perspective. And though at 14 she did give the baby up at her parents' urging, was the best thing. To this day, and now she's in her 30s, to this day she still kind of holds a grudge against her parents because they wouldn't let her keep the baby.
Now we've got more minutes of Greg Kokel and Carrie Gracie than we have of Issues, etc. So we're going to have to stop this at some point. I'll play a little bit more here because it's going to turn to, since the issue of rape has come up, Carrie Gracie of the interview on the BBC talking to Greg Kokel is going to raise kind of, here's the worst case scenarios. And these are the ones that when all other arguments fail, we find rape and incest. The one that she wants to use is rape. And she has some pretty startling statistics for rape. What I hope we get to here is one of her final questions. We might not have time for it. Maybe we'll play it tomorrow. And sorry, you'll just have to wait for it. One of the final questions she asked Greg is, if you could be shown statistically that outlawing abortion did not decrease the number of abortions, would you change your position? And he says, yes. He says, if outlawing abortion didn't decrease the number of abortions, and in fact increased them, he's not willing to concede that that would actually happen. But if it was, he says, my goal is to reduce the number of dead children as far as I can. And of course, it's never a perfect world. Now they're going to take up the issue of rape, warfare, and other circumstances surrounding abortion.
She wanted that baby. Abortion was never an option for her because of her own convictions, even at 14 years old. But she did give that baby up for adoption.
And, things we're talking about rape at this point, do you think there are conditions in which abortion is admissible? Because rape, as you mentioned, is often one that's cited. Another one, incest or
right.
danger to the life or health of the mother. Are these all legitimate reasons for abortion in your view?
Well, in order to answer that question, and I'm not going to argue this earlier point, but I just point out how important it is, we have to ask the question first, what is the unborn, before we can answer the question of what do we do under these difficult circumstances. My understanding of the medicine of it is that when the mother's life is in danger, like an ectopic pregnancy, for example, neither the baby nor the mother is going to survive in that circumstance. You're going to have two dead bodies on your hands if you don't act. And so the action medically taken
at that point
to remove
legitimate.
The child, that would be legitimate. But notice I'm dealing with both as valuable human beings. The other case, if the unborn is a valuable human being, we should not punish the unborn for the crime of that baby's father. In other words, we don't kill children simply because they remind us of difficult circumstances, as awful and terrible as those circumstances may have been.
Well, let me put an example to you. In Mexico, the government estimates there are 120,000 rapes a year.
Right.
So are you saying that the girls and the women who are unfortunate enough to become pregnant as a result of these rapes should be forced to continue with those pregnancies?
All right, we're going to have to wait for his answer to that question until tomorrow on Issues, Etc. Hopefully we'll have time to get it in. It's a good question. He is against elective abortion. He would like to see elective abortion outlawed in the United States elsewhere. And she asked the question, well, in Mexico you have a large number of rapes resulting in quote-unquote unwanted pregnancies. So would you force these women to go through with their pregnancies after this crime has been committed, to the victim of this crime? We'll get that answer on the other side tomorrow on Issues, Etc. A couple final thoughts here. He even dealt with this issue of danger to the woman's life and the ectopic pregnancy. That came up last week on Issues, Etc. And he said there, look, at no point do we treat the human embryo as anything less than a valuable human being. He came back to that question again and again. I really think it is the best question to stay with when debating the issue of life, and that is life and abortion. Who is the unborn? We try to go on and answer all sorts of questions and do all sorts of casuistry and respond to all sorts of special circumstances before we deal with the issue, who is the unborn? It's not really a debate about abortion. It's a debate about the unborn. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.